Russ Baker, when we last spoke, we talked about the filibuster, and you were giving us your superb analysis of how it all works. And you said that there were five separate times during the course of a bill that somebody could put a stop to it by threatening a filibuster. And we all watched Mr. Smith go to Washington and the filibuster. And you said something I thought was profound, which is it all depends on where you are about how you feel on the filibuster. Because when my liberal friends decried the filibuster and thought it ought to be done away with, I said, you better hold your tongue, because there may be some moment when it's all that's between you and going down altogether. For example, if you had had a Republican president, a Republican Senate, a Republican House, and a Republican Supreme Court. So you take it from there.
Right. I mean, there's a memorable speech by the then Senator Obama arguing for the virtues of the filibuster, because he was then in the minority. This was back in 2005. And he was a great fan of the filibuster. But today, I think if you were to ask the president, he would say, we have to find ways around it. The filibuster is something that in and of itself, I think, is very much at the heart of what the Senate is all about, and that's protection of minority rights. But I think the most justified criticism of it is that it is vastly abused, overused, used for trivial purposes, used out of personal pique rather than out of any policy difference. Mm. And it forces the majority leader, and I've seen Senator Reid at pretty close hand, trying to fashion ways to get around it. And it instills in a majority leader a kind of desperation, which often results in the majority leader basically denying the minority the right to offer amendments. And that can't be good. So I think that if there were, let's say, five Republicans who were willing to say, okay, let's eliminate one of the six points at which a bill can be filibustered. That is, the point at which the bill is debated on the floor. If that could be eliminated, and if senators were actually compelled to go to the floor and appear there to cite why it is that they're blocking the bill. It doesn't need to be a great deal of flowery oratory or certainly reading the telephone book or Cajun recipes, one of the many things that filibusters have done in the past, but just to say, okay, what don't I like about this bill? What's wrong with it, and why am I blocking it? That would be a good thing.
So you don't really see any major surgery occurring that will stop the filibuster as we know it?
No, I really don't think so. I mean, one of the things that's been discussed is the so-called nuclear option. What that is basically there are times at the beginning of a new Congress in which it is argued that that the rules of the Senate can be changed by a simple majority vote. Normally, it requires a two-thirds vote to change Senate rules, which, of course, is a supermajority. It's hard to get 60 votes. To get two-thirds of the Senate, 67 members, would be practically impossible. I mean, that's the same margin you need for ratifying a treaty. So, I think there's probably not a whole lot of chance that that's going to happen, because I think it would be just terribly destructive. I think it would really put the minority in a very, very bad position. I think that Senator Reid would probably want to avoid anything rather than to use the so-called nuclear option.
How do you think Mitt Romney did as a candidate?
That's a tough question. I mean, I think that, he was an adequate candidate. He wasn't a stellar candidate, and I think you needed someone who was really stellar. If you're the challenger, you really have to make a compelling case, both on a personal basis and on a policy basis, that you're superior to the incumbent. And, incumbents actually have a pretty good record of being reelected. That the voters don't lightly turn out an incumbent president. It doesn't happen very often. In the last 40 years, it's happened. It happened with George H.W. Bush. It happened with Jimmy Carter. But mostly, presidents who want a second term get a second term. And I think that being the case, I think it really calls for a challenger of outstanding quality to be able to to capitalize on disaffection. I mean, even when there is disaffection, I mean, certainly the economy is not robust. At the same time, I think that people basically felt that Barack Obama was just more attuned to their needs than Mitt Romney. And frankly, the Obama people did a superb job in framing Mitt Romney, even before the Republican primaries were over, as an uncaring, cold, unfeeling plutocrat.
Sounds like what I was saying, that first debate seemed to make a huge change. Quote, Obama lost the debate. We saw him lose a couple of points in the polls, which never came back. How important do these debates turn out to be now?
Well, you know, what happened in the first debate, I think there's a consensus about this, Alan, and that is that Republicans who were lukewarm on Romney felt better about him and came back. And that accounted for the slight upsurge in his poll numbers, but I don't think it converted anybody. I don't think there were Democrats who were watching that who said, "Oh my gosh, you know, I can't possibly support Obama. He looks so inert, and Romney looks, you know, so vital." I don't think much of that happened at all.
When Jack Kennedy ran for president, he gave that famous speech about being Catholic. We have the first African-American president in history in the White House right now. We had our first Mormon, you know, who could have been president. How much does that stuff mean in America?
You know, as the campaign went on, I think that Governor Romney's religion played less and less a role.
I think it was
much more an issue during the primaries. And I think that there were certainly evangelical voters who felt uncomfortable with Romney. I mean, you also had early on, of course, after he recanted, influential Christian leaders like the Reverend Billy Graham characterizing Mormonism as a cult. And I think that certainly dampened some of the enthusiasm that evangelical voters might have had for him. So, you know, he wasn't a natural fit with the modern Republican Party. He had to make too many adjustments. He had to modify himself too much. He had to appear to be too much of a shapeshifter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really hurt him.
The one person we really haven't talked about over the last couple of days is Nancy Pelosi. Now, I'll be honest with you, she's never impressed me. But when I talk to members of Congress, and I do all the time, they seem to love her. What am I missing here?
Well, I think you have to meet Nancy Pelosi and understand why they love her. She's an unbelievably charming person, incredibly gracious. She is not a naturally gifted orator. I think if you look at her speeches, you know, you sometimes see some mangled syntax and so on. But you know, she is one of these people who I think only the members really truly appreciate. Same thing with Harry Reid. I mean, people have expressed an absolute puzzlement to me. Why did the Democrats choose Harry Reid? This is not an eloquent man. As he once told me himself, he said, "Look, I'm not William Jennings Bryan." I thought to myself, that's an understatement. But I think she was able to provide protection for them. If they need money, she gets money. She's a prodigious fundraiser. And I think that inside Congress is where these decisions are made on leadership. And if Nancy Pelosi were up for popular election, I doubt that she would get elected as leader of the party. But it's what she does for the members, and they love her for it.
Just one addition that I can't help making, and that is I like Harry Reid a lot, and I sort of see in him a sort of Truman-esque way of operating. Do you see any of that?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I you know, certainly over the years I've known him, have really come to understand that his political qualities. He sees himself very much as a truth teller. He doesn't have a very active self-censorship gene, and he tends to say what comes to his mind, which is usually very blunt. You know, occasionally it upsets people. But there's a kind of directness to Harry Reid, I think, which is very appealing.
That's the rule of the Harrys. Ross Baker, we always love having you here, and you're very kind. We know how much in demand your words are. I know that you're constantly quoted in America's greatest newspapers where they're looking for somebody to explain things to them. And so we're very grateful for your being with us. Thanks so much.
Well, I'm always happy, Alan, to be able to reach your audience, which I think is undoubtedly composed of a lot of very thoughtful people.